Good morning and welcome to the May 22nd, 2023 meeting of the Chelan County Public Utility District Commission. I'd like to thank everyone for participating today and remind you to silence any of your electronic devices that you may have with you today. I don't believe we have somebody attending.
We just have some staff.
Okay. For those attending electronically, please mute your screens. Today's meeting is a study and business session with the study session starting this morning at 10 a.m. and the afternoon business session is scheduled for 1. However, I believe we will finish up everything this morning and get all of our business attended to this morning. We welcome the public's input at our meetings and remind you that these meetings are recorded. Members of the public are encouraged to ask specific questions after each item presented. And Rebecca and Kelly, if I forget to ask that, be sure to remind me to invite the public to respond after each item. Let's see. If you wish to provide additional comment or ask questions related to matters not on the agenda, time will be provided later on to do so. Please raise your hand and signal if you'd like to address the commission on any item on the agenda. And when recognized, please state your name and address for the record. Come up to the microphone when invited to and speak into the microphone. Please limit your comments to 3 minutes. Today we have 3 commissioners present. Kelly Boyd, Chief Financial Officer and Chief Risk Officer, will be sitting in for Kirk today. And we have General Counsel Eric Walquist and Rebecca, Clerk of the Board, joining us as well. This morning, would you please join Brent Thrapp? Did I say that right, Brent? Okay. In leading the Pledge of Allegiance and a safety minute.
Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, thank you for having me here today. My name is Brent Thrapp. And I'm the foreman hydromechanic at Central Maintenance and the dive supervisor of the Chelan County PUD's dive team. And I was asked to share a safety minute today. So I'm going to go over a quick idea that I've learned in the HPI, human performance that we've been learning here at the district. A simple idea that I want to share, and it's to make a job easy to perform correctly and difficult to perform it incorrectly. And that seems simple enough on the surface, but it comes with a lot of preparation. So I just want to ask a couple questions that you don't have to answer, just to kind of give you an idea. So has anybody ever used their hand as a fist or a hammer to kind of pound something into place? Have you ever used a knife as a fork? Have you ever used a screwdriver to open a can of paint? And also this one, which I'm sure we can all answer yes to, have you ever used a chair as a step stool? With those in mind, I want to talk about the chair example quickly. So if I go to change a battery in my smoke detector, I usually, after I find the one that's beeping at me, I grab the nearest chair, I get up, get the battery, realize I don't have the other battery with me, go down and get it, go through all that process. I have never fallen off the chair yet, but I feel like you're setting yourself up for the possibility of failure at some point. So how that looks in the HPI principle that I just talked about is if somebody had gotten a ladder for me and it was setting by the smoke detector, the battery's right there, it's probably easier for me to use the ladder that's there than it is to move the ladder and grab a chair. So that's the idea. And so how that looks for our crew at work, I get a work packet for for my supervisor and I read through that packet. I ask any questions if I have them. Then I go through the job in my head. And I have an example of that, which you can look at or not. I brought copies. But I just go through this process. This is my writing. This is my process that I've perfected in my own mind from beginning to end. And as the dive supervisor, that's from getting the diver in the water to getting them out of the water and everything in between and everything behind the scenes. So I go through that. I make sure it's perfect. Then I'll give that to my my lead journeyman, and he's going to look at it, my perfect scenario, and point out everything I've missed. And then we're going to work that together. I'm going to give it to my crew. We're going to go over it together as a crew, and they're going to further scrutinize that and make sure I know of all the other things I missed. And then once we're ready, we've got a plan in place. And then we should have every tool, every piece of equipment, all of our PPE in place, our personal protective equipment. And so we can pass these around if you like. I didn't do a PowerPoint. I don't know. I'm just going to show you real quickly what this looks like. So we start at the diver's depth, how long he can stay there, the clearances in place for our protection. Any red items are usually safety concerns or things to watch for. I got a list of tools for this job, and this is a job we do often, and this has been perfected over the years. It hasn't come out this way from the beginning. Anyway, I go through the whole thing, and it's step by step from access to the water to the very last one, getting the diver to surface. I'm not going to go all over those steps, but just to see the process it takes, it's a little time consuming, but the effort put into it makes sure that we do the job efficiently and safely. So, in my experience, people are going to not wait for the right tool if they're in the middle of the job. So it's my job, my responsibility as the foreman to make sure those tools are in place, safety stuff is in place, and we're ready to do the job as best we can. Otherwise, they're going to grab the chair and not use the ladder. That is my safety minute. Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Appreciate the analogy. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Very good.
Got me thinking. Where's my stepladder?
Thinking the same thing. Always grab that chair. All right. Thank you very much. All right. Approval of the agenda. Commissioners, management is recommending moving resolutions 12, 15, and 16 to the consent agenda. Additionally, for the public's information, items on the consent agenda are subject to transfer to the regular agenda upon any request of any commission member. Commissioners, do I hear any such request or additions to the agenda? All right. Agenda stands with items 12, 15, and 16 moving to consent. All right. Kelly, I'll turn this over to you for our CPO recognition.
Thank you, Commissioner McKenna. I'd like to invite up Angelica Fernandez and Kyle Schutte, please. Angelica and Kyle are both our Cyclo Person Ownership winners for this month. I'd like to start with Angelica. She was nominated for her fantastic level of internal customer service, demonstrating her commitment to our values of trustworthiness and operational excellence. She's noted for being the first to offer assistance, taking ownership of the task, and then diligently researching it to a successful conclusion. Her attention to detail and her ability to take long-term or to look long-term are valuable skills of particular note. So I'd like to thank you, Angelica, for your positive and helpful attitude and your demonstration of successful solutions. So thank you very much, and we always want to give the opportunity, but not the requirement, if you'd like to add anything.
No, I just, I've been in customer service basically since I started my working career, since I was 16. I am a people's person. I like to feel helpful. I like to help every way I can. So that's, yeah.
Well, and your coworkers are definitely recognizing that. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you, because it seems like you guys have had a lot of change happening, and you're the first line of defense in so many ways. So thank you for being such a strong team member.
Thank you. It's definitely a team effort.
I'll just take this opportunity. It's really interesting as a commissioner to be here, because usually I walk in and people don't know who I am, because we're not here that often. So as you walk into the lobby and you get to watch you guys interact with the public and listen to what's going on, it's kind of incognito, but it really is doing exactly what you said, Kelly. It's just fun watching you guys work and listen to the questions that are asked and the concerns and how you guys take care of customers. And we all really appreciate those efforts. Thank you.
All right. And then Kyle exhibited a cycle of personal ownership in multiple ways during the current time of peak workload and staff constraints for the help desk. So Kyle was proactive in recognizing the upcoming challenge, and he was quick to hire and onboard in kind of a very proactive manner of two new staff. Also to get temporary assistance in place to ensure good customer service, and then going above and beyond with his own hours to keep up with the demand. And all the while, he ensured his leadership was constant and informative to others. And he exhibited courteous, professional, and supportive behavior with both internal and external customers, all the while being under the pressure. So he exhibited the values of stewardship, trustworthiness, and operational excellence that benefited both the internal and external customers. So thank you, Kyle, for being calm and cool under the pressure and being proactive, and we appreciate your extra efforts.
Thank you.
And if you would like to add anything to that, you're welcome to, but not required.
Oh yes. Some of that there with like the hiring the team members and stuff like that. Michelle also gets credit for that. We worked as a team on there. I just want to comment that this team that we have is really incredible. It's probably the most dynamic team that I've worked with in any agency that I've been an employee of. So kudos to my Service Desk team, and thank you for recognizing that, this award.
I appreciate you saying internal customers too, because I'm in the line all the time for assistance. So thank you very much, Kyle. Appreciate the help. All right.
And thank you for your strong leadership. I'm reading the book Credibility. Are you familiar with it?
I haven't read Credibility. No, I haven't. Well, I know the term, but
yeah, but it's an awesome book that really focuses on building the trust. And so hearing that you have done that with your team is fantastic. Having that strong leadership skill set is valuable to us. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Appreciate it very much, Kyle. It sounds to me like you have some ownership here and putting in the extra time and things like that are required in leaders, and really appreciate the effort that you're putting out for the organization and your team. Thank you.
Thanks. We have a bit of a ways to go still, but we'll get there.
I'm sure you will.
Thanks for both coming and sharing with us today as well.
Thanks.
All right. Yep, thank you for leading by example.
All right.
All right. At this time, we'll move on to item four, our quarterly financial review and investment report with Mark Mullins and Dave Nelson.
Wait till Commissioner McKenna gets back.
Okay.
Oh, sorry. Continue.
Nope. Didn't want you to miss a minute.
Oh, God.
This is exciting stuff.
I know it.
Well, very good. Well, thank you, and good morning, commissioners. I'm Mark Mullins, Director of Enterprise Planning, Risk, and Analytics, and to my right is Dave Nelson, Manager of Strategic Financial Planning. And as we've done in the past, we'll jointly present our quarterly financial review, and for this meeting, for the quarter ended March 31st, 2023. So starting with the formalities, this presentation does support a number of resolutions that require quarterly reporting to the board with respect to our long-range financial policies, business line financial policies, our investment policy, as well as the balanced scorecard objective for the board of maintaining strong financial stewardship. So we're going to cover our financial highlights, our Q1 first quarter results. We'll take a peek at the five-year forecast, a brief look at our investment report, and we'll leave you with some key messages. This is an update only, no action required. There is a lot of detailed information in the appendix. We don't plan on covering that today, but certainly open for questions either at the meeting or after. We'll be happy to answer those. So looking at our Q1 2023 key highlights, bottom line results through Q1 better than budget by $12 million. Lower operating costs more than offset our lower revenues due to lower stream flow conditions, both contributing in total to those strong results year to date. You might look out and see the river. It's flowing pretty strong right now, but this is as of through Q1, and we have had lower stream flow conditions through this period and forecasted throughout the year. From a forecast perspective, our bottom line results, based on what we know today, better than budget by $9 million. Operating revenues are expected to improve and come in close to budget overall for the year. We do have heavy spending reflected in our forecast, as well as our budget that we set. We do anticipate continuing to advance on those projects. And as you'll see in our forecast, spending most of the money that's been allocated in our budget for 2023. We do continue to monitor supply chain and inflation impacts, and at this point in time, we find those to be manageable, but we'll continue to monitor those as we go forward and ensure that we get that information in our current five-year forecast through the business planning process. From a financial metric perspective, we are meeting our targets over the five-year planning horizon, and we do not have any external borrowing needs expected during this forecast period. So with that, staff is recommending to stay the long-term course.
Kelly, did you have a question you wanted to ask earlier?
Yes, thank you. I am curious, when our expenses, when our revenue is down and our expenses are often are down as well, is that a direct correlation or is it a reflection of projects that are being pushed aside? Or,
well, depending on the projects, if they're pushed aside, then we may have lower expenditures associated with that versus what we're planning for the budget. From a revenue perspective, we do have, and I'll get into that in a few minutes, our hydro cost-based contracts has a revenue component that's associated with costs. So that revenue will go lower as those expenditures are not realized based on what our expectations were for against our budget. So you'll see an offsetting impact there. Lower revenues, but lower expenses as well.
So not a concern that expenses that are being deferred are going to later hit when our revenue might also be down?
Potentially. It depends on timing, but mm-hmm. we do expect to spend that money. We've allocated those budget amounts for projects. Getting the timing just perfect is really difficult to do, but we do reflect that based on our best estimates at the time of budget, but also in our forecast as well. So you could have a little bit of a variation there in timing from our budget expectations, but we do our best to manage that going forward as we go throughout the year.
Thank you.
And if I could add also to that, that's also why we maintain a five-year forecast that we update quarterly for that period so that we could identify earlier if there are some pinch points like you're describing that may require different timing or different actions in order to make sure that we can support those projects. So we do try to make see those relationships early and take action.
Thank you.
Question. In talking about the projects later on down the line, you have the financial highlights on the balance sheet, and you have some projects that have been moved. It's about $8 million. Can you help me with that and explain why we do that now instead of later on in the budget? Or, you know, because this is the first quarter. So.
Right.
So why are we moving those now?
So as we move through time throughout the year, mm-hmm. we know more today than we did when we set the budget. So part of our quarterly processes is to go through, and actually ongoing processes, is to set that forecast based on the most current information. So as we get projects and we know a little bit more about project schedule or timing of the expenditures, then we inform that forecast that may have a little bit of a variation between what we set when we set the budget. And as you know, we set the budget based on an October forecast results. It gets approved in December, but that's based on our October forecast. So since then, we've had now 5 months of information that now we know a little bit more about those projects than we did at the time when we set that budget.
Yeah, because it always seems like at the end of the year, there's projects that aren't completed, and these are some of those. And you're going to show this throughout the year if there are more projects that need to be moved based on your information.
Yes.
And that sort of thing. So okay.
Yep. As we move through time, as we get more informed about those projects, then we'll note those items and which one of those we're getting deferred until a later period, for example.
Will you show that up continually as we go through the season, or does this kind of fall off?
No, we'll continue to show those and identify those if they're material.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll continue to point those out.
That's done quarterly?
Yeah, we do it. It's really, the forecast is maintained on an ongoing basis, but typically we see the most activity right before the quarter, and even more specifically as we get into business planning, so we want to inform our 2024 through 2028 forecast, for example. We'll do a deeper dive at that point in time, but then as we get in towards Q3, towards the end of the year, then that's when we know the most information, so we'll adjust accordingly so we have the best expectations of how we're going to end the year. But it's an ongoing, continuous process.
Yeah, but in our capital projects and stuff, is there a percentage we're trying to meet? In my discussions and stuff, we always talk about, well, there's an 85% mark we're trying to hit. Is that the goal?
So our goal is actually to spend it all.
Okay. That's what I want to hear. I mean, these are valuable projects, mm-hmm. and there's value associated with them, so I would assume that would be the goal, is to hit the 100%, but
yep.
I don't think we ever have.
Yeah, it's really a challenge as you go throughout the year because things change so quickly based on a number of factors that you may or may not could have foreseen at that time. But we do set the budget based on the best information we have at that time with the expectation that we'll complete all of those projects and spend all the money that the board has allocated for that budget. So that's our expectation, and then we do the best to manage close to that. And you'll see in this Q1 forecast, we have an optimistic view of how we're going to end up the year with heavy spending continuing throughout the year that fairly closely matches what our budget expectations are on a capital program. However, you know, as we go into Q2 and report to the board again, we may see some variations based on new information.
Okay. Well, I'm just curious why those items were being moved so early in our project process rather than, you know, kind of as you go down through the year, you have more information. But this seems to be fairly early in the process.
Mm-hmm. One reason that it helps with doing it as soon as more information is known, also because there may be the opportunity to then slot something in earlier than it was anticipated. So it helps with managing which projects are going at what pace. And we do just move, we're just moving the forecast. We haven't actually changed a budget. We're just trying to track that forecast to enable us to manage as a whole and move things up and down as more is known. So that's why it's helpful. As soon as you know that there's something that's likely that's going to be a different timing, because it gives the opportunity to change the plan around And we do keep that kind of rolling all through the year of both pluses and minuses.
That's a good question, but it's a good point though. We're getting that feedback more real time than just at the end of the year. By the way, this is how the end of the year report looks, and I appreciate that real time reporting back to us. Thank you.
No, I don't get me wrong. I appreciate that as well. It's just that as I look at this, and I've looked at other budgets in the past and stuff, there seems to be, you know, the capital projects is something I'm very interested in, and maintaining a high degree of accuracy, I guess, as we move forward.
Yep.
On this, because if they are important projects that need to be completed, then I think that should be a high priority for an organization.
I agree.
And in the event we have cost overruns where we might end up meeting our budget from an expense perspective, but not completion of the capital projects, how is that tracked, or how will I see that? So I know it's, does that make sense that the expense might equal what we budgeted, but the projects didn't actually get done?
Right. So we could experience that as well, just because of rising costs potentially, where our costs are a little bit higher. It could be simply timing of when we expect that to come in. But if there are impacts where a project is significantly exceeding what the board approved as a project budget, then we would come back to the board and speak to the board and identify what's driving that, what's causing that, and that we need to request more money for that specific project. So it does get informed over time. Depending on kind of how the timing all works, and with respect to the overall budget for the district and that system that project belongs in.
In the event of that situation, and we've seen the cost overruns and the change order requests, so I'm familiar with that. My question is more in the event there's a cost overrun on one capital project, that will not preclude another project from being completed. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
That is correct.
And so then on a budget level, if we projected $5 million and our budget is $5 million in expenses, but that included significant cost overruns on a separate capital project, then it's safe to assume, or you will let us know that future projects got kicked down the road, basically, and that's why there's not an increase in that actuals to the budget?
I guess.
Or is there a schedule that we see on, you know, I just don't want to get so lost on a budget. Our actual meets our budget, and yet we have projects that didn't get done.
Yeah, I see what you mean. And, of course, that would, if it rolled over into a different budget cycle, mm-hmm. then we would, of course, inform that budget with those changes for that particular project. But if you had a $5 million budget for two projects mm-hmm. and each costing $2.5 million. One ultimately is going to end up costing $3.5 million and the other $2.5 million. So the two of them were $1 million over what we expected mm-hmm. as a whole. But we would come back to the board for that $3.5 million project that used to be $2.5 million, and we would request a budget revision for that one, mm-hmm. while the other project would continue on.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you. Not wanting to beat a horse, I just want to make sure I understand what I'm looking at.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, there could be competing priorities that could be weighed also, but that gets into the granularity of each individual project and what that means and if there's any interrelationships between those two projects in this example anyway.
Thank you.
Of course, we have a portfolio of many more than two projects.
And more than $5 really million. Dollars.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So we'll focus first on our Q1 overview from a revenue perspective. We'll start off with that. So service revenue slightly above budget year to date. The primary driver in our off-system end-use sale, we do have a market-based component, pricing component. So in a market environment where prices are higher, we have the benefits of that in that budget category, and that is more than offsetting our lower usage volume in that particular case. And we have some slightly lower on our lower cryptocurrency load versus what we expected at budget. Net wholesale revenue, and you'll be hearing a little bit more about this in our energy resources presentation. Net wholesale revenue, $30 million below budget year-to-date. The primary driver is energy production is simply at 76% of what we expected at the time of budget, which we base on average water. So when we have lower stream flow conditions, that impacts our ability to generate. So our energy production at this point is 76%. We also have increased load through Q1. So when we have an increased load, then that means those megawatts are not available to sell into the wholesale market. So we're impacted by lower stream flows. And then because of that, we're also impacted by the higher market prices because we're purchasing energy in that case to manage that position in that portfolio. So the combination of those two items is putting us in this $30 million below budget deficit at this point in time. However, on the hydro contract revenue, that's where we're benefiting from higher market prices with retained surplus proceeds on the cost-based contracts in the amount of $31 million through Q1. And that's partially offset by the hydro O&M costs coming in. Cost of production is roughly about 76%. As we're seeing, hydro O&M is a little bit lower. So that's an example where you will see lower revenues only because our costs are lower on those particular projects. So that's where they have kind of a relationship between the two of them. Other operating revenue, $3 million above budget. A variable portion of the real-time agreement is the driver there. But overall, when you put all the revenue categories together, we're forecasted to be about $1 million better than budget for the year. On the operating expenses, $15 million below budget, primarily at the hydros with O&M and coming in at about 56% at this point in time, based on what we expected at budget time when we set that. We are expecting to catch up, so it could be a timing issue on some of those expenditures. We are expecting to catch up through the remainder of the year. From a non-operating net expense, $1 million better than budget. We've seen higher interest markets, so our investment income is higher. And overall, net expenses are forecasted to be about $8 million below budget for the year. So all things together, from an income state perspective, our bottom line is $42 million year to date, about $12 million better than budget, with our primary drivers being lower expenditures, plus the net wholesale, the net surplus proceeds that we received from the higher market prices, partially offset by the lower net wholesale revenue. From a forecast perspective, we're expected to end of the year, based on what we know today, $9 million better than budget or $112 million. Looking at our capital, so year to date, we're about 81% of our expectations versus budget, about $5 million below for the year, spending $23 million. We do have some adjustments that you're noting here, Commissioner Berggren. For example, the vehicles, we had an assumption that the timing is a little bit different than our assumptions that we were expecting when the forecast and the budget was put together way back in October of 2022. So that's getting adjusted forward when we expect those vehicles to be delivered. So that's an example of how things change.
Correct. Yep.
And some additional items on operations and service center. Obviously, that's a big year for this project. And then some delays on the substation expenditures and the loop trail extension. But overall, when you put all things together, our current forecast has us coming in at $219 million, roughly about what we expected from a budget perspective. Of course, there's a lot of variations and moving parts associated with that, but as we'll continue to monitor and we'll bring those adjustments forward and make sure it's transparent for the board of when that's occurring and informing that long-term forecast. From a cash perspective, increased by $44 million from the year-end results to $584 million with our improved bottom line, but also some collection of receivables as well. As you can see from the year-end cash balance forecast of $473, we're continuing to draw down those cash reserves in order to utilize that for our planned capital expenditures, as well as scheduled debt principal payments, as well as we continue to manage that throughout the year. From a debt perspective, our Q1 balance is $351 million, continuing to plan on $38 million at this point of reductions, ending the year at $312 million at the end of the year. unless there's any other questions, I'll turn it over to Dave, and he can dive into some of the details.
Thank you.
Okay, good morning, commissioners. This slide pulls it all together, what Mark had talked about there, as far as the bottom line of $112 million forecasted for the year, $9 million better than budget. And as you can see, the net wholesale revenue numbers is where we're below budget. The retained earning surplus proceeds are in the hydro long-term contract. That's why we're above budget there. And overall, a strong bottom line forecast of the year. I just want to take one quick divergence here and talk about the non-operating activity, something we don't talk about too much. But as you can see, this year we actually forecasted a small positive. The non-operating includes interest expense, interest income, customer contributions towards new connections and things like that that come in as a revenue line, in a sense, that come into the non-operating activity. And if you look historically in that number, it's been a pretty substantial negative or net expense, as we had substantial debt, and so our interest expense was substantial. And our forecast, even 2 years ago, our forecast for 2023 was for about a negative $10 million in this category. So changes that have occurred since that time of improved cash balances, reduced debt forecasts, as well as higher interest income on cash balances have resulted in our budget being an actual positive or net revenue, in a sense, in the non-operating. And as you can see, we're even forecasting higher, almost $4 million in that area due to changes since the budget time of higher interest rates, higher cash balances than what we had forecast. So it's just something that's we don't pay a lot of attention or talk about it a lot because it's a non-operating below the line kind of item, but it's been a big change for us over the years and is forecasted also in the future to be a strong or a positive for us, as we expect to have continued strong balances, lower debt levels, so less interest expense, and expect to have positives in the non-operating activity going forward. Looking at the business bottom line forecasts, the integrated electric, of course, mirrors the overall district results that Mark talked about in detail. The fiber and telecom, we're seeing slightly lower O&M expenses forecast, so results forecasted to come in a little better than budget. Water is forecasting a little bit of improvement versus budget due to some higher revenues, as well as interest income that they're seeing on cash balances. Wastewater is a little unusual here. We're forecasting a strong positive in line with budget. Most of that is due to a public power benefit contribution of $1.5 million, which is being credited into wastewater this year. And the interest system eliminations are due to the fiber.
Excuse me, Dave. On the wastewater, the $1 million figure from public power benefit, that's going to capital projects.
Right, and the way the accounting for that works, that becomes when we transfer the money over to the wastewater system, it's treated as a non-operating income item in this case, $1.5 million that was transferred to that system. So we have to record it that way to follow the accounting for it. It will be used for capital projects, and then we'll see eventually depreciation expense in those systems. In that system, as that asset is depreciated over time.
Right. I just wanted to make it clear that was just capital.
That's right. It is for capital. It's the way we have to account for it in those systems, is to treat it as a non-operating income item to transfer the money there.
Thank you for the clarification. Thank you.
Sure. Okay. Look at a little bit of detail on the capital expenditures by our systems. As Mark mentioned, it's early in the year, the first quarter. There's always a little difficulty in predicting when these expenses are going to occur. Two of our systems here that are well below budget, electric distribution and network transmission, are really below forecast, primarily due to projects related to the jump-off switchyard and substation projects and the very, very preliminary schedules that we had at the time the budget was put together. So those are lagging a little bit. Overall, though, as Mark noted, $23 million in expenditures. I would just note that's actually a very strong number for us for the first quarter, even though we're only at 81% of budget. $20 plus million is the best that I can recall in the first quarter. And definitely over the last 5 years, I looked back, even taking out what we've been spending on the service center for this quarter, which is an unusual project, which still is still quite a high number for us as far as first quarter expenditures. Overall, as Mark mentioned, we're forecasting being pretty much in line, and most of the systems pretty close in line to what the forecasted budget was, or the budget and the forecast. Looking at our cash flow year to date, we had the $42 million bottom line result for the first quarter. We add back some non-cash depreciation and amortization of $14 million, subtracts non-cash revenue items, which is the upfront payments received on cost-plus contracts. We had $53 million in earned funds from operations during the quarter. We had $23 million of capital project expenditures. We had actual capitalized interest of $2 million on debt, so debt actually increased because of that small amount. And we had collection of receivables, which is a primary driver of $12 million in source of cash there. So we had an estimated overall use of funds of $9 million. With adding to cash reserves combined with our earned funds was $44 million, bringing us up to the $584 million cash and investments at the end of the quarter. And looking at how that's held as far as restricted and unrestricted funds, if you look at the total liquidity, we're up slightly, about $37 million from the year end due to strong results and less expenditures than what we had expected. We do see the restricted funds for the hydro capital and debt has increased. That is due to new internal loans that were provided to Rock Island for $70 million. And Rocky Reach for $25 million that were completed during the first quarter. And we've actually expended some of those funds already on projects as we move forward. Would also just note the headquarters service center funds, strategic facilities funds, we continue to use those funds and we expect to expend those this year as the service center is completed. You can see our restricted funds at the bottom of the page, not much change since year end. And so overall, the $584 million in cash and investments. And our quarterly reporting requirements, we're forecasting being in compliance with all of our financial policies over the five-year forecast period. We have one metric where under the unusual case in days cash on hand, we expect to be within 10% of the metric. That's why it's yellow, but still meeting that metric during that time frame. Just note the bottom line results are shown here in a forecast. You can see they're very strong under the expected case and under the unusual case. And the debt outstanding, we're forecasting continued reduction of debt with scheduled payments throughout the forecast period. And you can see the debt outstanding under the unusual case is the same. And that's because we do not anticipate borrowing to support our investments in capital projects or operations. Even under the unusual case, we anticipate that we would have enough cash and ability to finance that without borrowing additional money.
Let's see if I can make a good question here. So when we look at total cash and investments from last year and this year, has that growth or decline remained pretty steady, just a nice, healthy increase? Am I asking, in other words, is it the direction we're going continue to be a steady, healthy improvement or increase in that cash and investments?
Yes, I think it's a very, very positive result and positive change we've seen over the past year or so as power prices have increased. It's been a big factor in showing stronger results as we look forward. So we expect to have better bottom line results, which translates into better cash balances.
And we would anticipate in our planning purposes, though, that it will be a steady decline over time as we continue to utilize some of those unrestricted funds and the restricted funds for capital to pay for our capital as you go. So we would anticipate kind of a steady decline. Mm-hmm. We've been bolstered by some of the revenue streams to keep it at a higher level than we even forecast. But we do plan to utilize those reserves for capital and then have a nice balance of debt and pay-as-you-go capital in the future. So I did want to give that feel of you would expect right. to see us to spend the cash down over time.
Because in the recent past, we've been talking about actually going into debt, using debt, which we haven't been doing. So I just wanted to get a picture of where that direction's going and where we're at. So that answers my question. So thank you very much.
Yes, we had been forecasting additional outside borrowing, and we are not at this point in our five-year forecast period forecasting external borrowing. We still see, as we talked about, the hydro loans to finance our heavy investment at the hydros. We are doing the internal loans, so we are not forecasting external loans at this point.
Unrestricted funds. I just assume that this is where everything goes, you know. And is there any kind of methodology around that fund, or is that just a unrestricted fund that's just there to pull from as far as debt or capital projects? It's just sort of I'm trying to understand what my question is, but it's. I don't want to say it's a slush fund, but it's a fund that's there to pull from to balance out all of these, what you were talking about, Kelly, is the debt. And that's because when I look at the bottom of this, you have on the debt, it's outstanding. You have the expected case and the unusual case, and it's just exactly the same. And
right.
So the unrestricted funds is where you pull from in order to balance that out for a projection.
That's right. In this case, if we were to have worse results as our unusual case is projecting some downside in terms of stream flow or power prices, things that would cause us to have a lower bottom line of what we are forecasting, that would essentially be, we would come out of unrestricted funds. As there would be less funds being produced
I guess what I'm thinking of is that if this unrestricted funds increases over time, do we increase our payments for debt? Do we try to pay down more debt than that? Because as that level gets, it could get higher, correct? And so is there a methodology around that? So, well, it's higher, so let's pay down more debt, or how do we manage that, I guess?
Yes, we have done quite a bit of that in recent years. We've paid down a lot of debt. Typically, our Treasury Department looks very carefully at our debt and our call provisions, which allow us to repay debt early. Otherwise, we're paying on schedule. At the moment, we don't have a lot of opportunities to pay ahead of schedule without really incurring the same interest expense that we, even if we paid it down, there's ways you could defease the debt and things that doesn't really make sense for us.
So it's arbitrary based on our current situation. There's no methodology around it. So, well, this is the maximum we're going to have an unrestricted, and then it just automatically goes to pay debt down.
I wouldn't say it's arbitrary. We do have required debt schedule payments that we have to make.
Correct.
Beyond those, if there's opportunities because the debt allows us to call it, then we do look at those, and we spend quite a bit of effort in making sure that we're making the right decisions and asset liability wise, taking a look at what our plans are, what our forecasts, where we're going to use that cash, what debt do we need to support our operations. And we have liquidity requirements as part of our covenants that maintain
the
total liquidity. Although it's unrestricted, it's not restricted, but we have to maintain total liquidity to meet our covenants and things. Okay. So you asked a question previously, how do we determine what's restricted? Is there rules? I mean, there are certain funds, if you go to the bottom of this and kind of go forward, these are very contractual restrictions at the bottom of this page that we're looking at here for self-insurance and other funds, our power contract deposits, the customer deposit from Microsoft, bond reserve funds. These are defined by contracts that we must reserve cash for those items. We can't use it to spend on something else. They can be used specifically for the projects that they're designated at the times that they're designated. As you move up into the restricted funds for hydro capital and debt, we include that in our total liquidity because it is used for our current hydro capital project spending as we are working on those projects. That money is available under the terms of those contracts to be used for those purposes. And then we move up to the board designated funds, which are restricted by the board. The board can restrict them or unrestrict them at the board's discretion. And we set aside money for the Headquarters Service Center Fund, and those are then being used according to the board's guidance to pay for that. Same as the Electric Rate Support Fund, the board designated that we would set aside a certain portion of the rate increases that are happening over time. It would be calculated in a certain methodology. Those are set aside in that rate support fund, again, at the board's discretion. And then you get at the top is the unrestricted funds. Those are available for any of the district's uses. But we do have our financial covenants that we want to maintain a certain amount of the total liquidity. At the moment, as you can see, this is calculated at $224 million was the policy minimum at the quarter for liquidity in order to maintain our strong bond ratings, our financial position that we want to maintain the district's strength. I guess I'm just
coming from a perspective years ago when we were had a different financial situation.
Sure.
Our unrestricted funds was quite a bit smaller, if I recall.
Right.
You're recalling correctly.
You're right. And now it's increased quite a bit. And I just didn't know if there's a methodology that works with this category or what. Or is it just there that we can pull from as a reserve account?
So, Dave, could you go to slide 11, please? The five-year metrics, financial policy metrics. So I think this will help, Commissioner Bergeron, because what we're trying to do is balance all of the multiple metrics. So one metric alone, like cash or your debt balance, doesn't give you the whole picture or enough of a picture. And you don't want to get out of balance on one and not pay attention to another. So we have the multiple metrics to help us balance that. And it happens in this view that the debt balance is the same under the expected and unusual condition, but that's not always the case. So as we always use the multiple looks, so should we find ourselves in an unusual condition, we have a contingency plan. And how that would look on these is sometimes we're falling below our metrics as we look to the future. And some of the action plans, which are part of our financial policies, would be maybe we borrow earlier than in an unusual case. And that's when you would start to see there would be differences in the debt outstanding balance because perhaps days cash on hand, that metric was getting to the limit that we try to manage to. And so that would signal to us that we would need to borrow debt to supplement to keep both of those metrics in balance. So these do guide us. They're the methodologies that we use to ensure that our financial path that we stay on is that healthy projected path that we have. So the methodology uses all of these, and they do relate to each other in the actions that you would take. And it just happens that the expected case and the unusual case are the same in this look, but that's just not always the case.
No, it just was draw my attention to it because it used to be completely different.
Yeah, so but hopefully that helps and gives you that feel. Sometimes you'll see lots of yellow on this because the metrics are getting close to the limits. And in the financial policy resolution, when we're within 10% of any metric, we're required to have an action plan in place of what would we do? Should we be stressed on that metric? And that's when you see the numbers vary a little bit more.
Okay, so the unrestricted dollars there is a minimum to that, right? That we trigger something once we get to a certain level, or could it go to zero, for instance?
No, there are triggers there that help us with that.
And then we borrow.
Yes, that's one of our actions that we can take. Okay. We have many choices of what we can do that, but we want to keep them all within our strong path we have.
Correct. I'm just totally different numbers, okay, that I'm used to looking at. All right, very good. Nice job. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Kelly. So looking at the quarterly reporting requirements for some of the individual business line financial policies, these are forecasted requirements for 2024. As you can see, they're mixed results. We're still working to get these systems to self-sustaining status. And you can see the operating cover for water and wastewater just slightly below the forecast required metrics in 2024. Fiber is now slightly above, but still within 10%, so that's why it's yellow. And as you can see, the debt service as a percentage of revenue for wastewater is above the required metric forecasted for 2024, and that is due to the different planning assumptions associated with the Shaston loan that we retained rather than repaid. Okay, looking at our quarterly investment report, as you can see, the district is in compliance with most of the policy objectives and all of our compliance requirements for our investment portfolios. We are below, continue to be below the return on investment policy objective, which is a comparison to the three-month treasury bill. We've Heather Ireland, our treasurer, came and talked to the board a couple of quarters ago, and we've continued to be to explain that situation as our longer weighted average maturity of our portfolio means that in this rapidly rising short-term rate environment, we have seen short-term rates rise above the longer-term rates, and there continues to be actually that inverted yield curve that we're seeing in the market, and the district's portfolio is being invested in longer-term maturity investments is slower to respond to rate movements up. We have seen a strong move up and is actually above our forecast for the budget with the district yield at 2.9% for the quarter and year to date, and also stronger invested book value of our cash investments that are invested. We continue to believe our laddered investment procedure policies kind of gives us a better overall return in the market, as well as stabilizing our cash flows and returns from our investment portfolio. And we're continuing to implement that strategy as we move forward. So overall, our key messages for the first quarter, the strong financial results for the first quarter, strong in certain areas, weak in certain areas, offsetting those, but overall, strong results, better than budget by $12 million. We're anticipating our year-end forecast, improving revenues in some areas, catching up in some of the operating expenses, and so forecasting a bottom line better than budget by $9 million. We're expecting our long-term financial metrics to remain strong. We don't foresee any borrowing in the five-year planning horizon to maintain our capital spending program. We do see inflation impacts. We continue to adjust for those and adjust our forecasts as we see need to, but we believe they're manageable. We're continuing to monitor and evaluate that. Our strong financial results really just further emphasize the district's ability to weather these changes and uncertainty and rising cost environment, and we recommend staying the long-term course. That's our presentation for today. There's, as Mark mentioned, a number of slides in the appendix, and we're happy to any other questions you might have.
Great. Great report. Commissioners, any other further questions?
No, thank you. Very thorough. Thank you for entertaining my questions.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mark and Dave.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Right now, we will invite Mike Bradshaw and Janet Jaspers to come up and talk about our quarterly energy resources update. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. Mike Bradshaw, Director of Energy Structuring and Trading.
And Janet Vaspers, Director of Energy Planning and Trading. Good morning.
Good morning. All right. Well, Mark and Dave went over the high level, so they kind of took all the fun out of this, but we'll go over some of the details here. So why we're here, our quarterly update for wholesale energy-related revenue update, what's going on in the Western power markets, and then just touching on operations and planning. Key points, as Mark and Dave pointed out, that 2023 is a below average water year. Our net wholesale revenue and other energy related revenue is projected to be $161 million, which is $4 million in budget. We'll go into the details there and you can kind of see some of the offsetting, so the reduction in the wholesale revenue offset by the retained net proceeds that were gained. Update on the Climate Commitment Act, the CCA. First auction was held in February. Touch on prices and the no-cost allowances. And then just an update on the market initiative, specifically the SPP Markets Plus and the CAISO EDAM. So with that, this first graph is the electric revenues forecast. On the far left is the forecast at budget. Next to it is the current 2023 forecast. So very, very close, about I think $4 million in increase from the budget forecast. And then you can see as you go out in 2024 out through 2032 that the top of those columns are above the green line, and that green line is the forecast that was at budget time, with the red line being the previous quarter's forecast. So with the increase in wholesale, or I'm sorry, increase in energy wholesale prices, it has shown an increase overall compared to where it was at budget for all years looking forward. Next slide here. Here's more detail into the 2023 forecast here. So top line is the energy sales and purchases, and that's where that negative $32.6 million variance is. Primarily a function of below average stream flows. Again, budget is assumes average forecast, and this was much below, as well as the cold winter through April at increased load, which is reduced energy that can be sold in the wholesale market. Below that line, you'll see the specified source premium is $2.3 million below, and right below that is the renewables bundled is $2.3 million above. So those really offset each other. Less carbon-free energy sold as specified source, and a portion of that was sold as a renewable bundled product. So really just a change in the products that were sold, but really the offset are still at forecast. The off-system end-use sales is up $3.1 million. And then you can see as you go down the line there, the $30.9 million increase from budget, and that's the retained net proceeds. As you scroll down the column there, you'll see the $2.1 million is an increase from budget for the real-time revenue, and that's really a function of volatility of wholesale prices. So with high wholesale prices typically brings higher volatility, and with that contract, we're able to capture some of that upside there. So that resulted in $2.1 million, which is $33.7 million for that category, which overall, bottom right-hand number, is $4.2 million in total above for a budget forecast. Next slide is our...
I have a question again.
Yes.
Can you help me with the real-time revenue then? You said that there's more dollars because of the cost. And then we have low stream flows, which is affecting our, I guess, our volume or capacity, what we can do. What really does happen when we have those low stream flows and it's throughout the Columbia River, the whole system, power rates go up? Where does the extra or the supplemental power come from in order to cover load during that time? Because the prices are going up. We've got to buy it somewhere. Where does it come from?
Yeah, so the whole WECC has to balance out.
Yeah.
So if it's lower hydro, that means some other resources typically coming on.
Is this coal?
I would say probably not so much coal as natural gas would be my first impact there. I think it would be more gas maybe in California or other places that would be burning more than they would have if you had hydro on. This is a good month to look at the rivers now. In month of May, it's just crazy out there. And right. So hydro is plentiful, and you'll see a lot of the gas units in the Northwest backing down because there's enough hydro to meet that. But in the absence of that hydro, a lot of the natural gas plants will fire up to meet that load.
That's the base load that's doing this. Rather than green or renewable energy, the wind and solar, variable.
I'd say every hour is probably different resource mix, depending on what's going on in the region. You could have wind overnight, solar during the day. Yeah. So those are going to pick up where hydro isn't there. But when it's needed and it needs to be on demand and neither one of those are performing, it'd be a thermal unit most likely.
Okay. I was just curious where that extra energy is actually going to come from. I know it's a higher price, and so it's pretty profitable for the gas industry at that time as well, right?
Right. A lot of times when the prices are what we've seen this last year and looking to the summer, it makes sense to use that gas, okay. Burn that gas to make that power.
Just curious. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Look at our energy commitments. Again, this is on the left is our fixed price position. On the right-hand table, our graph is our physical position. The look here is the policy limits is the top red line. And you can see in all years on both tables that the total energy commitments are below the red line, which is the policy limits. Just the quarterly update there. Fixed price slice contracts. Since the last time we had a quarterly update, we did execute another slice contract. That's that new blue color on top that shows up in 2024 through 2028. That was a 5% five-year slice that we executed back in March of this year. So continuing the rolling slice hedging program. And then an update in what's kind of going on in the West Power. First one here we have is RAP. The RAP is indicatively looking as if the first binding season will be shifted from summer of 2025 to most likely summer of 2026. Not official yet, but lack of participants' interest in 2025 will be the primary reason for that. The kind of the value of the RAP is having a lot of load and resource diversity or a lot of participants. And so not too many were interested in 25, so it's looking like 26 might be the first binding season. And Hishalan has officially moved our indication that we will be going binding in summer 26 as well. The Climate Commitment Act that started this year, again, January 1st, there was the first auction held at the end of February. All the allowances that were auctioned off were sold at an average price or a settlement price of $48.50 a metric ton of carbon, which resulted in about $300 million revenue to the Department of Ecology. There'll be four auctions. Basically one per quarter, and the next one is end of this month, and then there'll be likely one in August and December. There may be one or two in between, depending on price levels. There's some triggers there that would require more auctions if the prices rise above certain levels. Right now, the secondary market is trading those allowances kind of into $60 to $70 a metric ton, so it's steadily increased since that first auction was held. For a point of reference, California, carbon allowances are trading kind of in the $28 to $30. So about double up here in Washington. But smaller program, smaller footprint, but a more constrictive cap that's coming down more aggressively, too. It's putting upward pressure.
Is there any interest from California to get into this auction with us? And could you help me with that? What's going on there?
Yeah, there is lots of talk around linkage. California started theirs, I think, in 2013, and they linked to Quebec. I think they may have decoupled since then, but there was linkage there. And there is discussion about will or won't Washington link with California. So I think there's two sides of that, what makes sense. One is obviously they're a much larger market, so they'd have a lot more allowances, a bigger cap. Their prices are lower, so that would think that might translate up here to having lower prices in Washington. Does Washington want to link with California? and let those prices go down. So I think there's probably two strategies there, but it is definitely a topic of conversation in the West.
Okay, so what do we want?
I think for fungibility and for optimization across the WEC, it makes sense for one program, but obviously that has never happened. So we have these market seams issues that pop up. And so it kind of makes things a little bit more difficult to transact, to have all the emissions covered, to know there's no leakage between different programs, to make sure that one state that has a cap and trade program isn't just increasing the carbon in a different state. So I don't know if we have an official position on this. We are definitely watching it. It's definitely a topic of conversation.
There's a lot of financial impact,
right,
to Chelan.
Yeah.
No. Yes.
Yeah. No. So.
And yeah. The rules. You know, if we actually knew what the rules were and how they were going to hold us accountable to the rules, we could probably answer that question. So. Right now, Bonneville Power isn't part of the program, and so they're assigned a kind of a default emissions factor. So we import a lot of power, comes imported from the Bonneville Balancing Authority area, and so we don't even know what the emissions factor are from those imports, or if they're going to get counted as ACS, so asset controlling supplier emissions rate, which would be low, or the default rate, and how we can use those no-cost allowances. Can we use them against all the vulnerable? How can we use them? Will we have to put them into the auction? So part of the maybe is just because the Department of Ecology hasn't set out all of the rules, like what is the import, what is vulnerable's emissions factor going to be. And so, you know, we just got our no-cost allowances 3 weeks ago. Yeah, and the program started on January 1st. And so, you know, they're trying to develop all of the rules and interpret the WAC, but it's kind of slow going. And so ecology is forced to implement all of this regulation. They're short-staffed, they're kind of overwhelmed, they're trying to copy California program, and they're very slow to have answers, if they have an answer. And so a lot of times they just go, oh, we don't know yet. And then some of these no-cost allowances, if you don't use them in the program year, are they going to kind of claw them back after if you don't use them? So, and we don't know that answer to that question either. And so I think that's why it feels like Mike is saying, well, we don't know. And it's because we don't know the rules of the whole program.
Well, who makes the decision then if California comes in and we have one unified market? Who makes that decision?
Good question. I would think CARB, who governs the California program, in Shawnee.
They decide?
Because CARB and Department of Ecology would be likely ones to.
Yeah, probably along with Washington.
We have no impact on that at all in the decision-making?
It's probably.
Yeah, I think it's probably a joint. But I think, yeah, we can obviously have comments and work through, like, our PGP peer group where we have influence.
Okay.
To be able to submit comments to that effect.
Okay, that's interesting. Okay.
Now, a lot of the California entities, since their allowance price is half of ours, they're like, oh, California or Washington, your program is horrible. If we actually think our price probably is going to go up, I don't know, 20% because your program allowance price is double ours. And so if you have the difference in prices and you have that linkage, it's going to have to converge someplace. So California probably is not very incented to link right now with our high allowance pricing.
Hi, Sean Smith, Managing Director of Energy Resources. Yes, the California Air Resources Board would have to work with the Department of Ecology to work this out. Obviously, we have multiple organizations we belong to that we will work with and advocate for what is best for Chelan. So we have to get some final rules here. And, you know, sometimes the legislature passes something and then the regulatory is put, the ecology was put in quite a bind to implement these rules by January 1. And so that's what we're working through the process. They are working through the process.
Okay, thanks.
All right, so yeah, finish this slide up here. Janet mentioned that we did receive no-cost allowances April 25th. And so as we go through the year, as Janet mentioned, Bonneville is not jurisdictional, so it would be important energy from Bonneville that incurs carbon obligations. So we're tracking that through the year to see how many we'll have, and then we have these no-cost allowances to offset those. And then lastly on this slide, update on short-term market, kind of organized markets is SPP Markets Plus. Meetings have begun for phase one. There's 32 participants. I think they may have added a couple since then. So very strong showing for the Markets Plus movement, market formation. And then draft CAISO EDM language has been released, and the intent is to file that with FERC later this summer. So both markets are kind of still on path and moving forward as planned. With that, I'll hand it to Janet.
Thanks, Mike. This chart shows natural gas prices. And, I think last time we were here, we talked about the Sumas, which is the red line, which is our closest hub. And in December, we were seeing prices in the mid-40s per MMBTU, which we really hadn't seen that for a long, long time. Since then, prices dropped to about the $15 level for quite a while. And just recently, we're just up above $2 per MMBTU. Wow. So since kind of mid-December till now, price has dropped 95%. So we're watching that pretty closely right now, too, putting a lot of gas in storage. And we have so much hydro both in California and the Northwest that not very many gas plants are actually burning gas to produce electricity. This next chart shows Henry Hub, which is not Sumas. It was the orange line on the last graph. So this is in Louisiana. Is kind of just the standard that everyone tracks and trades generally. Since last time we were here presenting, the prices dropped down close to $2.17. So pretty big drop. Reason is pretty mild weather across the U.S., so not as much gas burn as was forecasted at that point. So prices dropped and storage is getting fuller, and so there's really not that much room in storage to fill much more yet. And just kind of zooming out of the last graph, it just what is in the yellow rectangle was just the time period on the last graph, and so pretty short time in history. We did have some big price spikes, but pretty short back in 2006 and 2008. So I think we've kind of touched on this, and Mark is going to touch on this with all of the financial metrics going out the next 5 years. So we have the MIDC forward price curve out this year plus 5 years here. At budget, if we kind of concentrate on 2023, at budget, the flat price was $89.16 per megawatt hour, and current forecast is $100.23. So a pretty big increase, about $11 per megawatt hour increase from budget time. But what's probably pretty significant for the district is the forward price curve and how much it has gained since budget. And so typically, kind of out here, if you subtract the two numbers, anywhere from probably $15 to $18 per megawatt hour increase since budget for those annual strips. Uh, switching gears and talk about one of our favorite topics, Lakeland. This time of year, we get a lot of interest in Lakeland, quite a few phone calls. Kind of you see this green line shooting almost straight vertical here. So in the month of May, the lake has filled almost 11 feet, which is, we've had just super warm weather. We had a couple of warm spells earlier in the month, and last week I think we had probably 5 days almost pushing 90 degrees. Inflows have been super high. We're currently spilling at 5,500 CFS spill. We like to stay below 6,000 just for erosion in that gorge. But kind of depending on what the weather does, we might have to spill a little bit more. And just kind of taking a date last week, the inflow into the lake was about 15,500 cubic feet per second. And kind of breaking down, so roughly about four, it's probably close to almost a foot inflow per day. And so we spilled about 0.4 feet per day. That's how much that volume spill would have filled the lake. We filled about half of a foot a day. And then we generated just 0.07 feet a day. So that's kind of the breakout of how we're managing. This time of year, I always like to think of it as threading the needle, just because we really have less than probably a foot and a half. We don't like to be in that top 6 inches, so have a less than a foot and a half to manage with spill and generation when you really don't know what the weather or the volume of the runoff. So kind of a rough place to be if you're John Wisniewski today. He manages like he does great jobs. And so that really wraps it up. Kind of talked about the low water and its impact on net wholesale revenue, Climate Commitment Act, kind of pricing of allowances. The next auction is May 31st, so we'll have some more intel on what the prices are, and hopefully we'll know how we can use all of those no-cost allowances. And then just on the organized markets, lots of action right now and activity with SPP Markets Plus and the design, and also kind of continuing to watch the Cal ISO day-ahead market design. With that concludes our presentation, so we could take any questions if you have them.
All right. I know we've asked a lot of questions as we've been along today, and I appreciate that information. Great report. Any other questions, commissioners?
Nope. Good job.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. At this time, Vicki Griffin will be up to talk about surplus property.
Good morning. I'm Vicki Griffin. I'm the manager of the real estate department here at the district. Just as a brief overview of what we, on when we have requests for surplus. So we'll have people come in and give us a call and say, well, if this is property, I'd really like to buy it. You know, are you willing to sell it? So just a real brief overview of our process. When we receive those requests, we internally vet those to find out if there's needs within the district for that property, if there's reasons why we shouldn't sell it, if there's a future need for the property. And then we if that is determined that we can sell those or could sell those, then we determine a value, bring it to the board, and that's where we are right now. So we have two of those today, one in Chelan Falls and one on the Chumstick in Leavenworth. Oops. So in Chelan Falls, we own actually quite a bit of property, as you can imagine, around the dam there. But this is a lot. Oh, where's the mouse there? this lot here is surrounded on three sides by this property owner who owns everything in green. We have a transmission line that runs through the property that on further review we do not have an easement for. Not sure what happened back then, but we don't have an easement for that across either from Crowell's property, and of course we don't have one across our property until we sell it. We again put that out to our internal programs to find out if there was any need to retain that piece. The only usable part of the property is kind of this grassy area. The rest of it's a real steep bank down to Hydro Park. The comments we received were as long as we retain an easement for our transmission line, there wasn't a need to keep that property in our portfolio. So we worked with the property owner. There's not a whole lot of value in that little grassy spot, and we're perfecting our easement across their property as well as retaining an easement for the transmission line as it crosses theirs. So they're paying us $500 for the lot and paying some recording and administrative fees associated with that if the board approves this. Second one is on the Chum Stick. This is kind of a busy map here. The owner of this mini storage here, which is in green again, has been kind of, his buildings run right up along, this is all district property back here. This is the Leavenworth substation. He's been kind of managing this property for, managed for weeds and fire danger, that kind of thing. And he approached us about buying this 20-foot strip behind his property. The property is actually, the proposed property line is in the middle of a kind of a storm ditch area, mm-hmm. and then up to his property line. So not a lot of value to the district. Other than we have underground and overhead utilities in that strip. He just wants to be able to maintain the property and take care of it. The feedback from our internal groups was, again, maintain all of the property rights that we need to make sure that we can do any future needs. We'll have future use for possibly through there for when we build a substation up there. And you'll see this red area. The exchange on this would be an easement across his property, which is all the developed property in there, or a future transmission distribution fiber corridor so that we could get through to Chum Stick. That was one of the things that I received feedback on, was that we currently don't have a path from our transmission line or from our substation to Chum Stick. So this kind of solves some problems for us, mm-hmm. Gives him the property he needs to safeguard his property and take care of it a little better for himself. So there's the exchange of value on this is just an easement, so there's no money changing hands on this particular one because we really need the corridor out to get to the Chum Stick. And the value of property completely encumbered by easements in a ditch doesn't have a whole lot of value. Mm-hmm. So that would be the request on that. This is a 20-foot strip. It's not quite an equal, as far as size goes, it's certainly not an equal ask, but the rights are similar that we're asking to exchange on that. So the request is to surplus those two particular properties. Did you have any questions on either one of those? I kind of rammed fairly quickly. Sorry.
So the request today is a motion to hold a public hearing. Is that correct?
Okay. Yes. So we don't literally, I mean, by law, we don't have to hold a public hearing for this. They're under the threshold. I think it's $50,000, the value of those properties. So we don't actually have to have a hearing for that. So that would be your decision whether you wanted to actually hold a public hearing or whether you wanted to sell them without. And Eric, did you have anything to add on that? Or is that
I would say Vicki's right in terms of the specific requirements. We usually, historically, we have had them as hearings. So that's, I think, the plan going forward. And the reason you see it as such, it provides some soak time. Doing the introduction today and then setting the hearing so folks will know if they have comment or concerns that they show up at that point in time to express those to the board. So it really is, as Vicki suggests, the board's decision whether you want to formally call it a hearing or not. The only difference is we put it in the paper.
Yeah. And I think it's been our past practice and it's a good public policy process to go through to continue. Commissioners, questions?
Just that if we didn't hold a public hearing, you would execute immediately on this?
So all of our purchase and sale agreements, I don't know if you have them executed already. I bet you do. Signed by the So normally our planning commissioner or our path is that we would try to get a draft purchase and sale agreement executed, actually, and then, of course, it's contingent or subject to board approval. So if the board doesn't approve of the disposition of the property, however it's proposed, then it just goes away. We do that for a number of reasons, but primarily it's so that we know the deal when we bring it to the board.
So I'll entertain a motion.
Okay, I'll move to set a public hearing to take a comment on June 5th, 2023 at 10:15 a.m. for the purpose of a proposed sale of district property 1, Chelant Falls, 0.18 acres, and 2, Chumstick, 0.15 acres, determined to be surplus to the district needs, and directing staff to publish public notice as required by RCW 39.33.020.
I second the motion.
Okay. Any further discussion? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Thank you, Vicki.
Thank you.
Commissioner, I just realized I didn't actually finish the answer to your question. The short answer is no. We signed the purchase and sale, but we would still come back to the board for a vote up or down on the approval, whether it's a public hearing or not.
I understood that. Thank you.
All right. At this point, do we have any members of the public wishing to provide public comment or questions to the board? All right. Hearing none, Kelly, let's move on into the consent agenda. I move into our business session. So at this point, I will take a motion for the consent agenda, which includes 12, 15, and item 16, resolution 16.
Mm-hmm.
I move to approve the consent agenda as amended.
Second.
All those in favor of the consent agenda signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. Okay. And let's see. Bear with me here for a second. There's a faster way to do this. But. All right. Resolution 13.
So thank you. I'd like to invite up Mitchell Clark for Resolution 13, which is a resolution approving execution of filled work order change order number 3-13 for the third and fourth units under contract number 14-22 with Voith Hydro, Inc. of York, Pennsylvania for Rocky Reach Units C8 through C11 turbine repairs.
Good morning, Commissioners. Yes, I'm presenting field work order 3-13 to contract 1422. So just for a little bit of background, this contract 1422 is for refurbishment of the turbines for C8 through C11 at Rocky Reach. C8 and C9 have already been completed as part of this contract, and C11, the third unit, is in progress right now. And then one important addition to this contract was the design of the water-filled hubs, which are going to be implemented for the third and fourth units, which will be the first on the Columbia and the largest in the U.S. So the changes that we're proposing to make to the contract, the first is changing the outage start date of the third unit to match up with the actual start date, which was January 23rd of 2023. The second change is updating the outage start date of the fourth unit as well from July 17th, 2023 to October 2nd of 2023. The third change is extending the runner turnover to the district, meaning the shop refurbishment time for Voith by a total of 14 weeks. And that 14 weeks comes from an 8-week extension that was requested by Voith due to current shop availability limitations. And then secondly, initial site inspections of our equipment are showing that As found, repairs are likely going to be needed in the Voith shop, and we've agreed with Voith that a target duration of those repairs is approximately 6 weeks. So the 8 weeks due to shop availability and 6 weeks for as found repairs have a total impact of 14 weeks to the shop refurbishment time for the third unit. Next, we're looking to add refurbishment scope to Voith to refurbish the Wickagate servo motors for both the third and fourth units. Next is also extending the shop time for both the third and fourth units by 5 calendar days so that Voith has time to perform hub balancing on the assembled runner assemblies in the shop. And the last changes are improvements proposed by the district for the water-filled hub design for the third and fourth units. The first is an addition of a low-level water sensor to the hubs, and the second is modification to the blade servo motor oil leakage collection system to better optimize the location of that equipment for long-term operability and maintainability. So the total cost of this field work order is $560,626.12. Any questions about this field work order?
Thank you. Okay, hold on for this award-winning resolution title. I'd like to welcome up Devin Myers while I'm introducing this. It's a resolution ratifying field work order change orders numbers 8 for GMP 1, 3 for GMP 2, 4 for GMP 2, 5 for GMP 2, 1 for GMP 3, 1 for GMP 4, and 2 for GMP 4, authorizing final acceptance of work performed under pre-construction services phase, guaranteed maximum price, which is GMP, amendment number 1, and GMP amendment number 2, and authorizing the issuance of the GMP amendment number 5 to North Bank Civil and Marine Inc. of Vancouver, Washington, to provide a GMP and schedule for the upgrade of the third unit, U8, under the contract number 20-14 for the Rock Island Powerhouse number 2 draft tube gate cylinder and hydraulic power unit upgrade.
Thank you. Yeah, I feel like I should just ask if there's any questions. And
right.
Yeah.
It was all right there in the title.
Yeah. Well, thank you, commissioners. My name is Devin Myers, as she said, and I'm a project manager down at Rock Island, involved in the Powerhouse 2 refurbishment rehabilitation program. We're using a progressive design build method to procure equipment and services from Maritime, Civil, and Marine for the rehabilitation of the draft tube gate systems at Powerhouse 2. As Kelly stated, this resolution is requesting to ratify 7 executed field work orders, authorize final acceptance for work performed under the pre-construction phase and 2 GMP amendments, and to execute a guaranteed maximum price amendment for installation of a new draft tube system on the third unit. We're also requesting a budget revision of $3 million for the completion of the planned work in 2023. This will increase the budget from $9.1 to $12.1 million. Okay, draft tube gate refurbishment project is related to the Powerhouse 2 refurbishment program. The benefits of this project are to ensure another 40 years of reliable operation, provide a higher hydraulic operating pressure to help overcome increasing friction that occurs over time, the use of an environmentally acceptable lubricant instead of petroleum-based hydraulic oils, and also the addition of a cylinder leak detection system. Okay, the draft tube gates are an essential component for the horizontal units of Powerhouse 2. It's crucial that these operate as designed. This project is replacing both the hydraulic cylinders and the hydraulic power unit that operates the draft tube gates up and down. The draft tube gates are used in conjunction with the head gates to unwater the unit during maintenance overhauls. They're used as runaway protection in case of a breaker trip, and they can also be used for sluicing operations. And sluicing operations are used during high river flows to pass water through the unit when the unit's not generating. Okay. Any questions on that picture? Okay. All right. This project was originally planned as an O&M project to refurbish the existing equipment and initially budgeted in 2019 for $7.2 million. Design changes to increase the system pressure and use environmentally acceptable lubricants necessitated purchasing new equipment. This changed the project from O&M to capital, which required the addition of district labor costs. This paired with material and labor escalation, reliability improvements identified during design, and working with generation management to select the lowest cost alternative, which included both project cost and lost generation revenues, has a current estimate of this project cost at roughly $17 million. Future budget revisions will be requested during the annual budget process. The current project schedule has us completing the final installation in 2025. And again, why we're here today is to ratify field work orders, authorize final acceptance for work completed, execute a GMP amendment for the third unit, and to request a $3 million budget provision to complete the work in 2023. I plan to return later this summer with another GMP amendment for the fourth unit that will be completed this fall. And again, as I've said, all future budget revisions will be requested during the annual budget process. Thank you. Are there any questions?
I just got one that we need to do this before we refurbish another unit. We try to stay ahead of the...
Not necessarily.
Oh.
You know, and we originally, this project also, when it was originally put together, we were going to try to do this in sync with all the refurbishments.
Yeah.
Which would make it a 10-year project and also cause us some other issues with... You need the unit watered up. We need to be able to run the unit. And when you're bringing a unit back online after refurbishment, it kind of was causing some issues there. But we also, when we got into the pre-construction phase, as we call it, and started developing the work scope of how this is going to work, we found out that we could actually do it during our overhauls. And so for the most part, we're going to be getting it done ahead of a lot of that big refurbishment, which is a benefit because we'll have less contractors walking around the powerhouse while we're doing some of the bigger work. So
yeah, okay. Just curious. Yeah, thank you.
You bet.
Thanks, Devin.
Thank you.
Thank you, Devin. I'd like to welcome back up Vicki Griffin for Resolution 17, which is a resolution authorizing the general manager to enter into a long-term orchard lease agreement with People Premium Fruit Company, LLC, for a parcel of undeveloped land located in Douglas County, Washington.
Thank you, and hi again. The district owns, of course, bought a lot of property as we developed for Rocky Reach Dam, and this is a parcel that we have maintained over the years for possible future licensing needs or relicensing needs. It's about an 18.7-acre parcel. It's located just north of Rocky Reach Dam, above Turtle Rock on the river. The property had been leased to WSU for a tree fruit research block until through the end of 2012. Since then, the district has managed the property through a combination of internal resources and service agreements. The internal resources were real estate, parks, facilities. It hit just about every department that we had. And at some point, we struggled with getting resources on site, so we started using service agreements for that maintenance. The service agreements, along with the cost of maintaining we share in a pump maintenance agreement with another property owner. We share 50% of the cost. The pump is appears to be kind of poorly designed in the way it's done, and it's older, so it's fairly expensive to maintain. And we share that cost 50-50 with another property owner. Those costs over the last 4 years have been about $22,000 per year to the district. People Premium Fruit Company, who owns the property that we share the pump irrigation agreement with, has approached us about developing the property into an orchard
So he'd like to enter into a long-term lease with the district that would replace all of our requirement that we have those ongoing costs for the $22,000 a year, that he would take over the entire cost of the pump maintenance and as well as the maintenance of the property. We've worked with Mr. Peeble to develop a lease with him, the terms of which we're bringing to you today for approval or disapproval. It's a 20-year lease with three five-year renewal periods upon mutual agreement. So if either one of us doesn't want to renew after any of those five-year periods, the lease would not have to be renewed. The annual lease amount is set at $510 per acre per orchard. That's about just under $7,000 per year for the first year, and then a 3% annual increase in the lease rate from that point forward. One of the key terms in order for us to have some ability to terminate the lease if we needed to for FERC licensing or for other purposes, there's a term in the contract that would provide for some reimbursement for capital costs to him up through the first 15 years, up to 100% of specific capital improvement costs for the first 10 years, and then decreasing by 10% per year after that. After year 15, there would be no reimbursement costs through the term of the contract or any renewals. The district can cancel the contract at any time during the five-year renewals by providing a two-year notice. So it gives us a lot of ability to decide to use the property for something else, particularly after year 15, but specifically in the later years of the contract or any renewal periods. People would be responsible for 100% of the repair and maintenance and all capital improvements to the irrigation pump system. He'd also be responsible for the weed and garbage and the care of the remainder of the property. So the district's staff and we just wouldn't have the outgoing costs that we have now for that. Any questions so far?
So, Vicki, this allows us to perfect our water rights and reduce our costs.
This not on this property. So this property, we already have the water rights. Okay. This is just be reducing ongoing costs.
Okay.
Just one question, I guess, goes there. Is there any liability concerns associated with this property with them using it for the district?
I'm not beyond the ordinary.
Okay. All right. He's also required to have insurance coverage that we require him, that our risk group looks at to make sure that any ongoing risk is mitigated to the best we can.
Okay. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Vicki.
You're welcome.
I'd like to welcome Justin Cornea for Resolution 18, which is a resolution rescinding and replacing resolutions number 22-14640 and adopting new telecommunication rates for wholesale communication services by service providers on the district's broadband system.
Thank you. Justin Cornea, Senior Network Telecommunications Administrator. So I presented on May 1st, and this time we're seeking the board's approval for the proposed changes, as well as the update to the DLL rates to reflect the previously approved resolution. Pretty straightforward.
All right. Questions?
Any questions?
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
And you haven't received any public comments since your last presentation?
I do not.
Thank you. And the next item is item 19, which is a capital budget revision. So would we like to present this before and then take them all together, or should I pause at the end of the resolutions?
If there's a willingness, it'd be nice to have action on the resolution separately from the motion, just because we maintain a separate motions log for those things.
So help me, let me back up there. So we're going to go ahead and do all of the resolutions up through 18 at this point, and then we'll move into 19. Okay. Commissioners.
I move that we accept all resolutions as presented through resolution 18.
Is there 13, 14,
13, 17, 14, 15, 15, 15, no.
17
and 18.
Right.
I'll second that motion.
Second. Any discussion on that? All those in favor of the motion of 13, 14, 17, and 18 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
No. Aye.
Motion passes.
All right, thank you. Now I'd like to move to item 19, which is the capital budget revision. Travis Tucker, I'd like to welcome you up.
It's for the East Bank Hatchery, which is situated on the Douglas County side of the Rocky Reach Dam. The East Bank Pump Building Project is rehabilitating the building that houses chemicals, electrical components, and the pump for the summer Chinook holding pond. The many upgrades that the building is receiving are highlighted by a new pump with motor control center, separation of chemical storage and electrical components, and a new building shell.
Thanks.
Before construction was started in 2022, a variance was processed with the intent to increase the budget. However, during the 2023 budget preparation, a data entry error was made, and the full amount to complete the project was not secured for 2023. Additionally, the extraordinary lead time for electrical materials has extended the project duration by 6 months. And this has increased district labor resources dedicated to the project beyond what was expected when the original budget was adopted. So in order to complete this project, the team requests to increase the budget of $1,778,523 by $561,477 for a total budget of $2,340,000. This request includes Washington State sales tax and a contingency of 3%. Thank you.
Can you help me with this pump? Does that run the whole hatchery, or is it just specific?
This is for the summer Chinook holding pond, specifically for that pond.
Just specifically for that.
Yes.
Now is that the one that is in the circular?
No, this is an elongated raceway.
On the raceway.
Yep.
Okay. I just clarified. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
Any other questions?
Thanks. If I may add, Commissioner Allen, this helps with your question earlier, too, around individual project budgets. This is one where, while there may be capital funds remaining, this individual project did need an addition to the project to recognize the total project costs. Mm-hmm. So this is an example where we would come to the commission at this level to have a budget revision for an individual project, even though there are other system funds still remaining in the capital budget. So I was hoping that would help connect to what you would see based on your previous question.
Thank you.
This time I'll accept a motion for Resolution number 19.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we accept resolution 19.
So it's actually a motion. It'll have to be read if you would.
Oh, you have to go through the whole. All right.
Yeah, please.
All right, here we go. I move that we increase the total budget for the capital project of R121006 East Bank Hatchery Pump Station Rehabilitation in the amount of $561,477. The current total project budget amount is $1,778,523. The revised total budget would be $2,340,000.
Okay. Let's see. We have the motion. We have a second.
I second.
Any further discussion? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Kelly, let's move into manager items.
All right, thank you. I just have one manager item and one comment. So first I'd like to invite Rachel Hansen up to talk about the Geauga State Park Playground Ceremony.
Good morning, Commissioners. Senior Communication Strategist Rachel Hansen, and I'm here to invite you all to check out a new playground at Geauga State Park. It's happening 3 to 6 p.m. on Friday, And we're presenting this new playground in partnership with a lot of different agencies. We're going to have cafe there with a flower making craft for kids. We're going to have NCW libraries out to promote Checkout Washington, which is a program where families can check out discovery passes from their local libraries. We'll also have a food truck with pupusas, and we're going to offer a La Torreya, which is a Mexican bingo with energy conservation theme to it, and we're offering prizes with that. There's State Parks is also offering free event parking, so you don't necessarily need to have a pass to park at this event. Just some background on this project. The old playground was 26 years old and had reached the end of its useful life. So back in fall 2022, we reached out to the community to ask them, what features do you want in this playground? And we received about 150 responses back from all over Chelan County and the Arondo community as well. And what we heard was that they wanted a new slide. They wanted the rubberized surfacing. They also wanted some shade to keep the playground equipment nice and cool. So we incorporated all of that into the design. And one thing that we didn't expect come out of the survey was that the Arondo families, many of them said that this is their closest community green space, but they can't access it because they couldn't afford the $35 annual fee for a Discovery Pass. And because they're Douglas County residents, they didn't qualify for our State Parks Pass program. So I want to give a lot of credit to Mario Cantu, our community outreach specialist. He spent 2 months tracking down a resource where we could get State Park passes, and he found one through the State Parks Foundation. They donated 50 free Discovery Passes, and we worked with Arondo Schools to distribute them to families of young children. So come out and see us on Friday. It's the culmination of a lot of collaboration and teamwork, and it's going to be a good time.
And then my only other item is just the quick comment that your quarterly project status updates are in your board packet, and just let me know if you have any questions. That's it for manager items.
All right. Commissioners, we have the need for a motion to schedule a meeting for our next mid-C managers meeting.
I move to set a special meeting on Tuesday, June 13, 2023 at 6 p.m. at Jack's at the Market, 1004 F Street Southwest, Quincy, for the purpose of holding a mid-C general managers and commissioners meeting.
Second.
Any discussion on that? Okay. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Commissioners, do we have any other commission items?
Not I.
Okay. All right. Follow up on delegation of action items from prior board meetings.
Thank you. So for the follow-up items from the May 1st board meeting, Kelly Scott will provide commissioners with the breakdown of the state budget and how much of that will be spent in Chelan County. So that is still ongoing. Follow up on delegation of action items from the April 28th Board Governance Workshop. Eric Walquist will provide commissioners with a list of board delegated authorities. And Rebecca Newman will send commissioners a list of standing board reports. And Commissioner Arsenault will work with Kirk Hudson and Rebecca Newman to draft a new group agreement. And then the follow-up on delegation of the action items from previous board meetings, where Rebecca Newman will meet with Commissioners McKenna and Allen to review board balance scorecard metrics after the board governance workshop, and that meeting scheduled for May 22nd. Which we've moved. Which has been shifted to June 5th. And then the last item is that Eric Walquist will meet Commissioner Smith and Allen to review the board governance policies after the board governance workshop, with that meeting scheduled for June 22nd. Confirmed.
All right.
And for delegation items from today, I'm looking towards Rebecca. I did not pick up any.
Didn't have any other.
Did we miss any of that you had?
No.
All right.
Thank you. This time, do we have any additional public comment? Hearing none, do we have any matters of general business as may necessarily come before the commission? Hearing none, we will be taking a recess and moving into an executive session for
30 minutes.
30 minutes. And we will do that in about 5 minutes. We'll take a short break.
We need to read the reason for
it. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
Eric, I forgot all about that. And I will
short
read
today.
I will read that. We'll be moving into recessing and moving into executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or likely to become a party, and or legal risk as authorized by statute, and to consider the minimum price at which real estate will be offered for sale or lease when public knowledge regarding such consideration would cause the likelihood of decreased price, also as authorized by statute, for 30 minutes.
Thanks. Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner.
We are coming out of executive session. No decisions were made. No votes were taken. Is there any additional business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we will stand adjourned.